Hello and welcome to another episode of Moon Walk Talk.
All your energy into your finger. Throw it out. Fire.
Welcome to Moonwalk Talks, the Michael Jackson podcast dedicated to searching out the facts, stories, and theories about the King of Pop. So, sorry if you clip subscribe because you thought this had something to do with NASA or Neil Armstrong. It doesn't. But hey, you know, stick around anyway, you might still enjoy yourself. I am your host, Jenkins. I am the only rapper whose music catalog nobody cares to purchase. It's funny, because it's true. Please do me a favor and go rate, review, and subscribe to Moonwalk Talks on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Also, I've noticed a lot of people are finding Moonwalk Talks on YouTube now. So, hello, YouTube people. Please click that subscribe button and give us thumbs up. We appreciate you. Hey, I know you do the social media, so come do the social media with Moonwalk Talks. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and, you know, tweet me your favorite songs or your favorite MJ pictures or anything you feel I need to see. I just love hearing from you all. But yes, I'm not going to waste any more time. Let's talk some Moonwalk. I'm sure you have all heard the story before, as it was such an important part of Michael Jackson's history. You know, the story about Michael Jackson buying the ATV music catalog? Or, as some headlines would put it, Michael Jackson outbids Paul McCartney for the Beatles songs. Most MJ fans know the bullet points. Michael and Paul become friends, Paul teaches Michael about publishing, then Michael famously outbids Paul McCartney for the Beatles catalog, ending with Michael and Paul no longer friends. But no, there is so much more to the story. So, on today's episode, we are going to take a look at all the events and fill out all the details that led to this purchase, the relationship between Michael and Paul before and after the purchase, and what exactly the ATV catalog is, what are publishing rights, and every interesting detail in between. So, strap on your learning caps. Moonwalk Talks is gonna learn you something today, folks. In 1960, an English rock band by the name of The Beatles was born.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Beatles!
The band consisted of George Harrison, Ringo Starr, John Lennon, and Paul McCartney. Now, I shouldn't have to explain to you all who The Beatles are. If you don't know, stop listening to this episode right now and just go spend the next 3 weeks Googling The Beatles. You will thank me later. They are widely regarded as one of the greatest bands that have ever walked this earth. They have created classic pieces of music that have shaped modern music and have been the inspiration for thousands of artists and musicians for decades. I can't rave about The Beatles enough. They are one of my favorite bands of all time, and my favorite song of all time is actually a Beatles song. Yeah, it's not a Michael Jackson song. Sacrilege. I know. Only being a band for about 10 years, The Beatles became the most successful and influential band of all time. Unfortunately, all of this came to an end in 1970 when, due to personal conflicts within, the band decided to call it quits. After the dismemberment of the Beatles, one of the members, Sir Paul McCartney, decided to start his own band called Wings in 1971. Wings went on to do fairly well in the 70s. They had a string of top 10 albums and singles, but never quite hit the level of success that the Beatles had. 1970, The same year as the Beatles disbanded and Paul McCartney started up his new band Wings, a group of brothers from Gary, Indiana were starting to make waves on the singles charts.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you
of course,
the Jackson Five.
The Jackson Five. Between 1969 and 1977, the Jackson 5 and later the Jacksons would be sharing the music charts and timeline with Paul McCartney and his band Wings. In interviews, Michael was open about being a huge fan of the Beatles and growing up listening to them. But up until this time, they had never met. Sometime in 1977, at a mutual friend's party in Hollywood, Paul McCartney approached Jackson for the first time about a song he had written.
First met Paul McCartney, he came up to me. He said, "How you doing?" I said, "Fine." He said, "You know, Linda and I wrote a song for you." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You're kidding." And he started singing. He said, "You want to hear a little bit?" I said, "Okay." And they started breaking out singing it. So we switched numbers and everything. They gave me their Scotland number and England number. And we got in contact with each other, and we talked and talked. We started Heather, a good friend of mine, too.
This song turned out to be Girlfriend. In Michael Jackson's autobiography, Moonwalker, he claims that Paul had written the song with him in mind, and when first meeting Michael, he exclaimed that he would love for him to record it. But this is Hollywood. See, people exchange numbers and talk about ideas they would like to see happen all the time. And they don't normally come into existence. So, in such a Hollywood move, neither one ever contacted each other to make anything come into existence. And instead, Paul recorded the song for his 1978 Wings album, London Town. Year when Michael began work on his breakout solo album Off the Wall, his producer Quincy Jones, not knowing the history of the song, brings it to Michael's attention as a possible selection for the album. Excited and inspired by being able to sing a McCartney original, he agrees to record the song. Later, in 1980, it was released as the fifth and final single from Off the Wall. Michael, Paul, and Quincy's Girlfriend became another big hit for Michael Jackson. After this collaboration, the two became friendly, so they stayed in contact and started talking about their next project together. Eventually, Paul invited Michael to stay with him and his wife Linda at their home outside London to work on some song ideas together. These writing and recording sessions would birth the collaborative songs Say, Say, Say and The Man.
It was actually upstairs here.
It was here?
Yeah, it was in this office. It was upstairs. Michael originally rang me, said, "Do you want to make some hits?" I didn't know who it was. I didn't recognize his voice at first. Yeah. Anyway, I got into it and I said, "Yeah, sure I do, you know." So he came over, we agreed to meet here, and went upstairs. There was a little piano upstairs and here, and we just sat around. I had a guitar and the piano, and we just said, "Right, so what should we do?" So we just started, like you do, And
you on the piano, kind of thing?
I was on the piano.
It sounds like a song that was sung on the piano to me.
I think I was. But I had the guitar in case I wanted to show some sort of line or something. So we just did it upstairs, and it came very easily.
Yeah.
No, because I was quite excited to write with him. He was quite excited to write with me. So we were popping off each other.
Yeah.
And so we just did it. As I say, it was quite a short session. And we were in the same room, face to face.
Just surprised. I thought it was going to be a correspondence thing.
No, it was live, and we should just did it. And I just wrote the lyrics down, you know, and said, okay, that's it. We you know, when we were writing it, we were both in this sort of little sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Oh, come, hey.
Well,
you know, that's kind of how he sings anyway. Yeah. So I was kind of going along with that. I didn't want to suddenly go, say, you know, and he's doing the little voice. So I like doing that little voice as well, you know, so we...
While the songs were written and recorded in 1981, they wouldn't be released up until 2 years later, in 1983, on Paul's solo album, Pipes of Peace. It was also during this time that Michael spent at Paul's home that he would learn about the importance of publishing rights and royalty distribution. He would inform Michael that over the course of a year, he had made over $40 million in publishing royalties alone. As the story goes...
We wrote two songs together, and during lunch or something, he just took me aside and said, I'd like some advice. So I felt kind of big brotherly, you know, quite a bit older than him. So I said, for a business, you ought to think about music publishing. It's because it's a very good business. You love music. I'm into it. It does very well. It's a nice, easy business for a musician to be in. And it's a very rewarding business because it's music, right. Songs, beautiful songs. So he kind of said, okay, you know, and that was the end of it.
Okay, so let's take a quick break from the story so I can tell you about publishing.
Yeah.
There are a few different ways artists and songwriters get paid, but for this demonstration, we are going to form them into two groups and call them songwriting royalties and publishing royalties. Royalties is just a fancy way of saying money. Let's say you create a song. For this demonstration, the song you wrote is called Blue. Now, as soon as you create this song, you are the owner of the song. Nobody can take that from you. Blue is yours. You are the songwriter and publisher. Songwriter means that you created the song. And by publisher, it means that you get to choose how and when your song is used, whether it be performed by an artist or played on the radio, TV, commercials. And in that, anytime somebody wants to use your song, you get paid. All the money goes straight to you. But unfortunately, most songwriters don't know how to get their songs on TV and radio. So, as great of a song as Blue is, nobody's heard it.
Nobody's heard Blue.
This is when you seek out a music publisher. Many major music publishers have hundreds of contacts, connections, and people that are more equipped to get your music into the ears of those you want to hear them. Either by placing them in commercials, TV shows, performing them live, other people performing them, or sending them to radio DJs.
Please listen to Blue.
Now, it's a bit different nowadays with the internet. Artists now have many more accessible platforms to display their music to millions without the help of a publishing company. But back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, having a music publishing company was the best way to get your music to the masses.
Hey.
And the more people hearing and buying your music, the more money you make.
Money.
But a music publisher isn't going to work for free. Oh no.
What?
They will take up to half or more of your music rights and sales.
Did you say half?
Yep, half.
There goes half.
So, before you signed with the music publisher, you owned and made 100% of the money from your music. Now, you only make half. But, if you think about it, what's better? Half of a million or 100% of nothing? So, artists would reluctantly choose to lose half of their publishing rights and money in order to reach more people. So, say you weren't the only writer for your hit song Blue. Say you wrote it with your buddy. Well, your buddy also deserves a part of that cut. So it's coming out of your 50%.
Oh no.
So now you only own 25% of the rights and are only making 25% of the money Blue makes.
Oh, there it goes. Bye-bye, money.
Blue is now part of a publishing company's catalog. And as long as it remains there, you continue to receive money or royalties for your song. So, how would you lose publishing rights of your song? Well, lots of different things can happen. You could get caught in a bad contract, you could get manipulated by the people representing you, or you could have never owned them in the first place. Also, as it happens with so many musicians, they make bad financial decisions and decide to sell off the remaining percentage of the song they own for a quick cash-in.
Oh, geez.
Music is a business, one of the biggest in the world. Songs can be sold and traded just like the stock market. And the bigger the song, the longer the life, the more money it can make. Investing in songs can be just as important as investing in any other viable market. As with everything, there are tons of loopholes and rings to jump through. And you would be naive to think a person wouldn't screw you over to reap more rewards from your creations.
Not me.
Just like any other business, whether it be banking, real estate, or car sales, the snakes run the garden. It's not right, but it happens. So, if you didn't cross all your T's and dot all your I's, you just lost the publishing rights to your song, Blue. Now, just because you lost the publishing rights to your song Blue, that doesn't mean you won't still make money from your song. Because fortunately for you, you and your buddy are also the songwriters. So you are still entitled to songwriting royalties, which means that you will always get paid a small percentage of anything that song makes, even after you die. And this is what happened to Paul McCartney and the Beatles. So, back to the story. When Michael was staying with Paul and Linda in London recording Say 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 and The Man, Michael was curious as to how Paul was doing so well financially through music. Legend has it that after dinner one night, Paul brought out this big leather book full of all the songs he owned the publishing rights to. He explained to Michael that you can buy the rights to other people's music who had either sold it to the publishing companies or lost it in deals gone bad, and in turn, make money by selling their music. His publishing catalog famously included Buddy Holly songs, some Broadway hits, as well as a number of other unnamed artists. They then discussed how Paul and John had lost the publishing rights to the Beatles catalog, and how Paul was trying to get it back. And in what Paul thought was a joke, Michael exclaims,
"We were chatting, and he just came up to me and said, 'I'm going to buy your songs, you know?' And I went, 'Yeah, great, you know, good one,' and we just carried on. And then a few weeks after that, he said, 'I'm going to buy your songs.' I thought, well, it's a bit of an old joke by now, but very funny, all right, yeah."
A year later in 1982, Jackson and McCartney teamed up again to write and record what would become The Girl Is Mine for the Thriller album.
Every night she walks right in my dreams. Since I met her from the start, I'm so proud I am the only one who is special in her heart. The girl is mine. The doggone girl is mine.
Michael recalls it as one of the most enjoyable times recording as a solo artist, because him and McCartney would just have a lot of fun. The Girl Is Mine was the first single to be released off of Thriller in 1982 and is considered by many critics to be the weakest song on the album. But that didn't stop it from reaching the top 10, peaking at number 2 on the Billboard charts and selling enough to be certified platinum. Once again, the writing partnership of McCartney and Jackson proved to be a commercial success.
Don't waste your time.
But nothing could prepare the world or Michael for what was about to happen next.
Michael Jackson is back in action with his new album, Thriller.
He released released hit single after hit single, Billie Jean, Human Nature, Beat It, Back to Back to Back, Wanna Be Starting Something, Human Nature, PYT, Michael Jackson was on fire. I don't need to go into all the numbers, we all know that history. Greatest selling album of all time, yada, 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 you know the rest. This was 1983. Thriller mania was in full effect. And in a strategic move, Paul released the single Say Say Say, featuring the hottest selling artist at the moment, Michael Jackson. Say, say. As stated before, the song was written and recorded in 1981, but wasn't released until then. Say 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 became Michael's seventh top 10 hit that year, helping Michael Jackson break the record for number of top 10 hits, a record that was previously held by both Elvis Presley and the Beatles. So, in a way, Paul helped Michael Jackson beat his band's own record. Say 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 was another huge success for both Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson. It held a top 10 spot for 6 weeks and is now considered a platinum single. Unlike previous collaborations, the pair decided to shoot a music video for the song. It's a cute music video where Jackson and McCartney play Mac and Jack, a couple of con men who are selling a miracle potion. They also do a little fun vaudeville act and pursue the interests of some ladies also featured in the music video, Linda, Paul's wife, and the always lovely LaToya Jackson, Michael's sister. Now, on previous episodes of Moonwalk Talks, I've kind of made fun of the idea of LaToya playing Michael Jackson's sort of love interest in that video. I always saw it as a bit strange, but in all honesty, it's just a music video. It's fiction, it's two people playing a role, they don't kiss her or even hug or anything, they're just playing make-believe. And believe it or not, they're not the first or the last siblings to play each other's love interests. Jason Bateman and his sister Justine Bateman play characters that proposition each other on Arrested Development. Britney Spears and her cousin Chad Spears played love interests in her debut video, Baby One More Time. And even Frank Sinatra plays a cop trying to get the attention of a woman played by his sister, Tina Sinatra. So, it's just acting. But speaking of LaToya Jackson, in her 2011 book, Starting Over, she claims that while shooting the video for Say Say Say, the McCartney family was staying at a place called Sycamore Ranch. MJ took a liking to that location, and he said that one day he would like to buy it. And he did, for $17 million, turning the property into what we know now as Neverland Ranch. So, in retrospect, for the little time that Paul knew Michael Jackson, from teaching him about publishing to the introduction of what would become Neverland, Paul had a major impact on many aspects of Michael Jackson's life, even if the music they collaborated on wasn't as fruitful as some would have hoped. Between 1981 and 1985, Jackson began searching out publishing catalogs to buy. Michael instructed his lawyer at the time, John Branca, to bring him possible publishing selections. Michael was very selective about the songs and catalogs he would purchase. He didn't just buy up everything. He would pick and choose the songs that he felt were classic, or songs that meant something to him. One of his first big purchases was the catalog of Sly and the Family Stone, which he bought with a few other selections for around $500,000. Which he made back fairly quickly after a cover of one of the songs blew up on the music charts. Once publishers got the word that Michael Jackson was in the market for publishing rights, he had received quite a few decent offers to purchase songs, but nothing he felt was worth it. Until one day, Branca gets the info that a purchase called the ATV Catalog becomes available. And in this catalog are over 250 classic Beatles songs. So, let's take another quick break. How did the Beatles lose the rights to all their songs? Well, let me give you a quick rundown. Before the beginning of Beatlemania, their manager, Brian Epstein, convinced the 23 and 21-year-old John and Paul to sign a deal with longtime publishers Dick James and Charles Silver. Dick and Chuck would take 50% of the publishing rights, while Epstein got 10 and John and Paul each got 20. By the way, this is a terrible deal, but being young and unknown, the boys went along with it. And to be fair to Dick James, there was no promise of income for using his time or shopping the music for a relatively unknown band. He was essentially working for free. These individuals combined would be a company called Northern Songs. This would include all of their original recordings, and they would also be legally obligated to create at least 6 new songs a year until 1973, which Dick and Chuck would also own 50% of. In 1965, while trying to dodge taxes, Dick and Chuck made Northern Songs a public company. By public company, that means that anybody can invest in the company, not just private investors, which reduced everybody's percentage of ownership. Dick and Chuck at 35%, John and Paul at 15% apiece, and Brian and the rest of the public making up 35%. A while later, after their manager Brian Epstein passed away, John and Paul fought to get their full publishing rights back. But in a move of retaliation, Dick and Chuck sold the entire Northern Songs publishing, even John and Paul's shares, to a company called ATV Music Publishing. ATV stands for Associated Television. In this move, John and Paul were making pennies on the dollar from the royalties of the Beatles songs, which of course, they deserved more. Not only that, they had to continue to write more and more songs yearly due to their horribly constructed contract. So in order to end the madness, they sold a small percentage of remaining rights they had to ATV in order to get out of their contract, which means they no longer owned any of their own music. Now, of course they were free to continue to create their own music, but this was 1969, the last year of the Beatles being a band. Now, it's not like Michael Jackson didn't have his own experience with not owning his publishing and songwriting royalties, but you gotta give him a break because he was a kid. The Jackson 5, unlike the Beatles, did not write their own music. They had a team of writers and producers that created all of their hits, and so they retained no ownership or rights to any of the songs. Berry Gordy, the owner of Motown, and the writers are the ones that reap the majority of the Jackson 5 royalties. What Little Michael and the Jackson 5 received were called performance royalties, which means you get a small percentage of your version of the song. For instance, let's go back to your fictional song, Blue. Say Janet Jackson heard your song and really likes it. So, with your permission, she takes your song, Blue, and then records her own version of it. So anytime that song makes money, she would get performance royalties, which equals out to the smallest percentage of the money collected. You, the songwriter, would reap your songwriting royalties, and then of course, the publishers of the song would take the bulk of the royalties. So in the Jackson 5's case, they got paid a small percentage anytime their version of the song was played or purchased. In the music business, artists, especially those who do not write their own songs, don't get paid much. So, as an artist, you're not getting paid nearly as much as the writers, producers, and publishers. And this, along with creative freedom, is what ultimately led the Jacksons to leave Motown. So, crazy enough, early on, both Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson had a taste of what it's like to not have ownership of their songs. After that, the ATV catalog didn't switch hands until 1981 when an Australian billionaire named Robert Holmesicord bought the publishing catalog. He had no real interest in owning the catalog. He felt it more of a buy small, sell big transaction. So he fired all of the ATV staff and put the catalog on the market. And that's the end of part one. On the next episode of Moonwalk Talks, we will get into how Michael Jackson acquired the ATV catalog, how the catalog ultimately saved him on more than one occasion, the fallout between Paul and Michael, the beginning of the My Jack Music catalog, and the tragic story of what happened to the catalog after the death of Michael Jackson. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Moonwalk Talks. I appreciate you taking these journeys with me. As always, I'm your host, Jenkins. Please go rate and subscribe to Moonwalk Talks on iTunes, and please don't forget to follow Moonwalk Talks on Twitter and Instagram. And if you are listening and watching on YouTube, please click that subscribe button and give us a thumbs up. If you have any suggestions for a show topic, please send me an email to jenkins@jenkins.net. And if you are enjoying the show, please go tell a friend or two about it. Thanks again for giving me your time. And remember, no matter what happens today or tomorrow, keep your head up, keep the faith, and don't forget to smile.